Is there a way to prevent autism?
Stomach cancer and fighting infections in Latin America.
Better throw away those calcium supplements, and that's for everyone now.
And checking on the price of surgery may not be so hip.
Oh, no. That's what we're talking about on PodMed this week. That's the week of February 14th, 2013. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas in San Antonio.
So, Rick, we are starting something new this week, and that is we're giving the date that we record. That's because we've heard from a couple of listeners requesting that specific information when they want to go back and check the exact citations. So for those who want this, now you have it. We're going to start this week with something I served up as now it's time to throw out those calcium supplements, and that means everybody. That's based on a study in this week's British Medical Journal, taking a look at the dangers of calcium supplementation in women.
Elizabeth, there's been a lot of interest in using calcium supplementation to prevent fractures, particularly in people that have low calcium levels or low vitamin D levels. Unfortunately, several studies have suggested that the increased calcium intake, especially above certain levels, may in fact be harmful. This particular study we're going to look at investigates whether long-term calcium intake is associated with cardiovascular mortality. And they did that in what's called a prospective longitudinal cohort study. They had women that were enrolled between 1987 and 1990. They were followed for about 19 years, and they had dietary surveys when they were initially enrolled, and then a second dietary questionnaire later. And what they discovered was that when they looked at the total calcium intake, not only what they received from their diet, but if they took any supplements or tablets, that compared to the women that took between 600 and 1,000 milligrams per day, those that took 1,400 milligrams had a 40% higher likelihood of death, about a 200-fold increase of having ischemic heart disease, and about a 50% risk of having death from cardiovascular disease. It wasn't just a calcium supplement, but it was actually the total calcium intake.
So we have, of course, seen data just recently, but even a couple of years ago, suggesting that there was a risk. Largely, this was in studies conducted in men. So I think it's really good that this is a study conducted in women that's showing that the same risk exists.
This is one of several studies that show the same thing. So none of these prove it independently, but together, the data look pretty convincing that excessive calcium intake, very high calcium intake, is associated with increased risk of death and cardiovascular disease. And there's some biologic plausibility to it as well. High calcium drives our vitamin D levels down, and that's not good. High calcium is associated with an increased risk of high blood pressure, inflammation as well.
Let's talk about the relationship between dietary calcium and the coronary calcium score.
There's not a very good correlation between those two. One can have a high calcium uptake in their coronaries from anything that causes atherosclerosis, but there's not a correlation at all between the amount of calcium in your coronaries and your dietary calcium.
Well, that's good news because now everybody's having coronary calcium scanning.
That's really only beneficial in people that are considered to be at intermediate risk, but that's a different podcast.
Okay. Since we're talking about supplements then, let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association. A look at folic acid intake in women prior to pregnancy and early pregnancy and its relationship to the development of autism in their offspring.
The whole issue of autism has gained a lot of interest because, as we've talked about before, it looks like the incidence of the prevalence of autism is increasing. We know that there are some genetic risk factors associated with autism, but there's also appears to be some environmental things as well. And one of the issues that's raised is whether the intake of folic acid or folate could somehow influence the prevalence of autism. We know that women that have decreased folic acid or folate during early pregnancy have an increased risk of having children that have either neural tube disorders, things like spina bifida, and also learning disabilities. So this study addressed the issue of whether folic acid intake or supplements were somehow associated with the risk of autism in children. And they sampled 85,000 children from a population-based study called the Norwegian Mother and Child Cohort Study. And what they looked at was the exposure of the mother to folic acid 4 weeks before conception to 8 weeks after. And what they discovered was that in children whose mothers took folic acid, 0.1% were born that had an autistic disorder. And it was twice that amount, 0.2%, in those that were unexposed to folic acid.
As we've talked about, in this country, of course, lots of breads and cereals and so forth are already supplemented with folic acid. So women are getting adequate folic acid just dietarily. Do we need to be taking supplements if we're thinking about becoming pregnant?
That's a great question. In this Norwegian study, the mothers who took folic acid were recommended to take 200 to 400 micrograms of folic acid. In the U.S., for pregnant women, we recommend they take 1,000 micrograms. Based upon what we get in the United States, women get 150 micrograms, and that's probably not adequate. In fact, these authors hypothesize that that's why in the United States, the incidence of autism looks like it's continuing to increase, despite the fact we've now added folic acid supplements to grains and cereals, as you mentioned.
For right now, then, what should women who are contemplating pregnancy do, in your opinion?
In my opinion, and supported by either this data or the other data we've talked about, women should take somewhere between 400 and 1,000 micrograms of folic acid, beginning at least a month before they're thinking about conceiving, and then continuing at least through the first 2 months of pregnancy.
Let's turn from here then to something I find really quite interesting. This is in JAMA Internal Medicine. Trying to find the true price of hip replacement surgery. I bet I don't even know.
And the reason this is important is because as patients, we're now considered to be consumers of healthcare. Oftentimes, we are asked to find the least expensive forms of healthcare because we're responsible for some of the cost. So this was a fascinating study. What the investigators did was they claimed to be speaking on behalf of a 62-year-old grandmother that needed to have a hip replacement and did not have insurance. And they called the top-ranked orthopedic hospitals in the United States and also the two largest hospitals in each state. And they asked for complete pricing information for an elective hip replacement. And they made up to 5 calls to each of these institutions. What they discovered was of the 20 top-ranked hospitals, more than half of them, 55%, could not provide a single bundled price. And by the way, for the hospitals not in the top 20, 90% couldn't provide a single bundle price. You say, well, that's a little disconcerting. What's even more disconcerting is for those that could provide a price, there was a shocking variation. The range of the price was between $11,100 to a high of $126,000. I guess what our listeners should know is this doesn't really inform anybody about what the value is. So even finding out about price really doesn't give the entire picture.
Yikes. And of course, as we're all increasingly being called upon to both shoulder additional percentages of our medical care costs and be informed consumers when we walk in the door, this is really particularly scary.
Yep. You really can't talk about making things more cost effective when you can't figure out what the cost is.
Okay. Finally, then, I think we're going to be hearing a whole lot more about this particular issue, though. About what's it cost, and we really need a real cost related to particular procedures.
I think you're absolutely right, Elizabeth. And what this points out is we're a long way from there right now.
Well, let's hope we get there pretty quickly. Finally, then, let's turn back to the Journal of the American Medical Association. The risk of recurrent Helicobacter pylori infection, that bug that infects people's stomachs, is implicated in the vast majority of ulcers in Latin America.
People might be saying, what's this have to do with me eradicating an infection that causes ulcers in developing countries? Well, first of all, we have a number of listeners outside the United States. As you mentioned, this is an infection of the GI tract that leads to ulcers, but is also associated with gastric cancer. And gastric cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death worldwide. Many of these can be traced to the chronic infection with H. pylori. And in studies conducted in a certain province in China, when they treated H. pylori infection, and they decrease gastric cancer incidence by 39% over a 15-year period. So what this study did was it looked at different antibiotic regimens of treating H. pylori infection in Latin America. They went back a year later. How many of them had repeat infections? Recurrence had occurred in about 11% of individuals. They traced that to several different risk factors. One is, were they adherent fully to the antibiotic therapy they received? Where they were geographically located? And third, were there children in the household?
What about the presence of children in the house?
Well, children are oftentimes vectors for this. Women with children in the household had a higher incidence. Again, this whole issue says is how do you give cost-effective prophylaxis in developing countries? How do you do that inexpensively, and how do you do that effectively?
Interesting. And I guess this is also something that we're going to see lots more information on as time goes on.
Yeah, this is pretty amazing, Elizabeth. If we can decrease cancer incidence by 30 or 40 or 50% by giving antibiotics for as little as 5 days or 10 days to as much as 14 days, that is a substantial impact globally.
Indeed. On that good news note, then, I'll reveal that I am going to cover the calcium supplementation and cardiovascular disease risk in women on this week's blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.